Thank you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at FisheriesPod. If you are the generous sort, you can be like Ben, Tyler, Janet, Robin, and John, who all support the podcast on Patreon. Through Patreon, you're able to support the show with either a recurring or one-time donation, which helps us pay for various parts of the show. If that isn't your thing, you can also purchase Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks on our Teespring store if you feel inclined. So check it out. Our guest today is Amy Robison. Amy, aka the Pond Lady, is an aquatic ecologist specializing in private pond and lake management and restoration in Oklahoma. She was born and raised in Oklahoma and grew up on the water with her family. She received her bachelor's in biology with an emphasis in fisheries management and a minor in conservation from Southeastern Oklahoma State University and a master's in zoology from Oklahoma State University. Her thesis there was focused on ecotoxicology, specifically multiple stressor effects in bioassays. In 2011, she was hired on full-time by the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation and spent 4 years as a hatchery technician at the Durant State Fish Hatchery before transferring to the Oklahoma Fisheries Research Laboratory as a research technician. In 2017, Amy left the state agency to work for her husband's company, Robison Wildlife Solutions, as a pond specialist. Welcome to the podcast, Amy.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
The bio mentions that you grew up on the water with your family, and many people in this field have memories of fishing with their parents, but you actually were able to do fisheries field work with your mom. How were you able to do that?
Okay, so when I was in high school, pretty much knew early on I wanted to do something science-related, fisheries specifically, and got really good grades in all of my science classes. I got good grades across the board, just like a lot of people in this field. I really liked school. I really wanted to get ahead. And so I started doing college classes while I was still in high school, concurrent classes. My mom was doing her master's at the time at the university that was there in our town. And because I was doing concurrent classes and she was getting her master's and I was constantly going to see her and bugging her while I was on campus, I got to know the professors. I kind of was that tag along kid, no matter what stage of my life of where are you going, if it's water related, I want to go. And because I was a part of the university with concurrent class enrollment, I was eligible to go out as a volunteer as long as I signed volunteer paperwork. And, you know, mom's right there to take care of me and the professors knew me. So I got to tag along on field work when I was still in high school.
Was your mom taking courses just as electives or is she also in kind of the wildlife conservation field?
Well, her and my dad both sort of had a little bit of crossover in terms of their career objectives and then what their interests were. So my dad was always interested in environmental law, sustainability, environmental science. And at the time that he was in school getting his master's, that really wasn't a curriculum at Oklahoma State University. So he got his master's in political science instead. My mom wanted to do science education and didn't really like as much of the education curriculum as she did the ecology and sort of taxonomy classes. So for her master's at Southeastern, after getting her bachelor's in science education, she decided to get her master's in technology, which included classes like limnology, ichthyology, and some of the higher classes that were more geared towards fisheries, but weren't necessarily a part of her science education, biology, like undergrad stuff that she had done. So they were electives in terms of, you know, she was way more interested in getting out in the field, ecology, water stuff. So yeah, I was always around lots of science in terms of ideas and working knowledge, getting to go to lakes, to rivers. We didn't have a lot of pets growing up, but we always went out and got close to nature when we would travel as a family.
While you're at Southeastern Oklahoma State University, you also were able to do an internship with the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History.
I did.
And so you were born and raised in Oklahoma. Had you traveled to, is it in D.C. or New York?
It's in D.C. And that was a It was a fluke, actually. That's a not a story I tell a lot because I forget about it, kind of. You would think you wouldn't forget about something like that. But with everything that I've done in my life, it's kind of one of the many awesome things that's on the list. So it tends to get pushed aside sometimes with some of the newer accomplishments. I was in the honors program as an undergrad. A part of my scholarship was being in the honors program. You had to do a lot of the honors requirements, which were often extracurricular, either presentations or seminars, workshops that you would have to attend. One of them was with a woman named Dr. Carol Baldwin, who came to do a presentation about her research. She has studied in different parts of the world and a lot of marine studies, but she was actually doing work in the Galapagos Islands. She was in an IMAX film. She just so happened to do a guest presentation at one of the workshops at our university. And I got the gumption to go up to her, talk to her after it was over and say, hey, you're doing exactly what I want to do when I grow up. I would love to talk to you more. You know, if you get the chance, here's my email. I'd love to converse. And she said, apply for this program. You know, we pick students from all over the country, but just apply. And of course, me being the pessimist I am, I never thought I had a chance to get a spot. And in fact, I didn't get picked in the first round. I was an alternate and something happened to one of the original picks and I got called up and they said, do you want to come to DC for 3 months? And I said, of course I do. And I packed my bags. And so I did essentially what almost boils down to a master's type project in a 3 month period of time with Dr. Baldwin there at the Smithsonian. And it was really, even now, it's one of those things you look back on and like, did that really happen? I mean, was that real? I really got to walk around the Smithsonian at night behind the scenes and the collections. And, you know, it was an amazing opportunity.
You mentioned you did kind of like a whole master's project in 3 months, I guess. What were you looking at for that project?
Okay, so this was back in 2002 when getting the DNA sequence of an organism was not just as easy as it is now. And so there were a lot of burgeoning studies to show that different populations of organisms should be speciated based on their genetic code, right? So there's a species called the red-lipped blinny. It's an Atlantic species of blinny that had these five specific populations we were interested in looking at that are separated by thousands of miles. So zoogeographically, they are isolated. So based on the genetic sequencing of these five populations, the people that had determined the genetic sequences had indicated these five populations should be separate species, that they had enough separation that they should be actually distinct species. So our job was to actually go to the preserved specimens that they had in the Smithsonian collection and find morphological characteristics that could actually support the speciation of these different populations. Was it something that was distinct enough that we could say, okay, yes, there is something morphologically that can support this? Or is this just simply a divergence over time because of the separation, because of geography? And, you know, it came down to one specific population had a different vertebral count. So yes, it needed to be separated. So we were looking at X-rays. We were looking at, you know, ray counts. We were looking at pigment characteristics, anything externally, internally, shapes of bones, shapes of pieces of cartilage. We looked at cleared and stained specimens, anything that would give us that, you know, degree of separation to say, yes, this should be a separate species. And really, it came down to one single population had a darker chin strap. And so we were able to propose a subspecies, but it just, you know, I mean, that just as an undergrad and somebody that had always wanted to do that lab-based research and actually performing all of those tedious counts and specimens and doing everything you could to try to separate them, it was like, okay, I get the whole splitters versus lumpers argument now, because really, I mean, do we separate these? Is it really fundamental that we separate these? And if so, why? So I came away, I think, with way more than I, in just the experience of it all, I came away with a deeper understanding of where I wanted to go with my own career, what I wanted to do in terms of research, and even how I felt about species on the planet. So it was a great experience. Plus I got to I got to meet scientists that I never would have anticipated meeting, like E.O. Wilson, which was huge. Actually get to do a workshop with him at the Smithsonian, you know, and talk to him one-on-one. That's, I mean, Carol Baldwin alone, she's already an icon in my mind, and E.O. Wilson, meeting him in person, that's pretty fantastic. So
yeah, that certainly sounds like an extraordinary opportunity you're able to have. I'm not familiar with the Southeastern Oklahoma State University and what kind of schoolwork you had going on there, but was your experience in at the Smithsonian kind of first time you had done a lot of that type of work, or was it all new to you, or had you had a little bit of dabbling in it as your undergrad?
Well, definitely a lot more field oriented type work that we did at Southeastern. Luckily, you know, my emphasis was in fisheries management. So I took ichthyology, fisheries techniques, you know, introduction to aquaculture and herpetology and aquatic ecology. And so it was much more field based in terms of what our degree plan was designed to teach us, not a lot of lab based activity. And I had always thought that I really wanted to do aquaculture for sure, but I anticipated being much more drawn to the very regimented lab work. And I mean, that the Smithsonian, there's nothing that can beat that experience, but I definitely realized I wanted to be outside, out in the field, and much more working with live animals, looking at behavior in real time rather than trying to study it after the fact.
And you mentioned in your notes to me that you were one of 20 students chosen. So it's a pretty small group of people that have had that opportunity, but you also had the typical undergrad student jobs that you worked in a call center where you claimed you perfected the perfect customer service voice to help seem helpful when you didn't feel like it. Do you have any weird stories of customer service experience working that job?
Yes. Well, I don't know weird, but maybe sort of patting myself on the back is I have a supreme ability to turn it on and turn it off, so to speak. So when I started out, you know, as a rookie, you go through training and a lot of people don't make it very far because it's rigorous and people call in and they're really angry. You know, I was doing call-ins for basically, you know, my DVD isn't working, my VCR isn't working. Remember VCRs and DVD players? When, yeah. Mm-hmm. So like, I can't get my remote to work, or this, my TV isn't working. And so usually by the time you're calling someone, you're really angry at that point. And a lot of people didn't make it very long at the center before they would just give up and quit. So I was really, really good at being able to take somebody who is very angry and not only making them feel like they were very cared for, but also getting them to call me sweetheart by the end of the call. So you get something just raging, angry, and you know, you're calling them, yes, yes, sir, yes, yes, ma'am, I want to get that, I want to take care of you. You put them on mute and you're just like, oh my gosh, we're gonna have to, but yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. We'll get that right out to you, back on mute. Okay. No, we're going to have to take care of them because they're not going to leave me alone, you know, but just the ability to take care of the customer, no matter what's going on back here, no matter what they're going on, what they're going through over on their end, but just being able to connect with somebody, take care of them, make them feel like they are actually a person somebody actually cares about them and wants to take care of them. Now, whether or not we actually did half the time, I don't really know. I wasn't on that end of it, but it prepared me, I think, for my new life now on the outside of, you know, any protection of any agency, of being my own entity. It definitely, it prepared me for being able to connect with somebody when they're not feeling very good, when they're not in a good spot, when they're at the end of their rope, or they don't know who else to call. And even if you can't help them right away, it still, it taught me something, I think, that was a skill a lot of other scientists don't get. They don't make you take customer service classes when you're an undergrad getting your biology degree. You know, a lot of people aren't necessarily forced to have to work at a call center. So I think it's something extra I had under my belt that prepared me in different ways that are good for a lot of different aspects of this job that I didn't put together until now that I'm older and I see those connections and I see where simply telling somebody you care can go a long way.
I could definitely see how that would help you with the public relations part that isn't necessarily taught in school. And it's a really big part of this job now, having to deal with the public and make them feel better about the decisions you made, or in your case, make them feel better that their pond isn't completely ruined, that it's able to be fixed. So,
right. Very true.
Moving along chronologically, you finished your undergrad there in Durant and eventually made your way to Stillwater, to Oklahoma State University, and mentioned that your master's degree was studying ecotoxicology, specifically multiple stressor effects in bioassays. And I guess I could take a stab at what that is, but I could have no idea. So why don't you explain what exactly you were studying for your master's degree?
Generally, when you talk about how toxins affect aquatic organisms, generally what you see in literature is this specific chemical causes this effect in an organism. It's always this and this. Very rarely, to my knowledge, were there ever really studies that showed how an organism's behavior could inherently affect its ability to either uptake or not uptake a toxin. So sort of the reverse. So there were plenty of studies that showed how taking these toxins in, exposing an animal to these toxins, changed their behavior. But there was very little to show how the differences in behavior between aquatic organisms inherently affects different rates of uptake. So another aspect of this is when a lot of these guidelines for different toxins are set. So effluents, what can be pumped out of an industry into a receiving system, the acceptable limits that are set by the EPA usually are based on bioassays that are exposing an organism, one organism or multiple organisms, to either one chemical or a mixture of chemicals over a range of dosages. And then they look at the different effects. So either total mortality or how many different organisms are affected at different concentration levels. Anyway, there are different ways of reporting what levels of a toxin cause an organism to either be affected or to die, right? Now, these tests are done in a lab, and usually everything about this test is regulated in terms of it's controlled by a human. It's done in a lab. It's using usually water that's made in the lab to a specific set of specifications for hardness. You are dosing them at specified dosages across a different range from low to high. You're exposing them in a controlled amount of water. You grow the organisms yourselves in the lab usually. You know, like when I was doing the study, all of our organisms were reared in the lab from cultures that we reared over many, many generations. So, you know, how much like wild populations are these lab reared organisms? You know, how much like wild conditions are these bioassays? And our argument was also that they aren't, in these controlled experiments, adding things like pheromones, or pheromones. So pheromones being the protein alarm cues from different species, or pheromones, which are alarm cues or alarms substances within the same species. So depending on what an organism is exposed to in the wild from just being alive, i.e., you know, let's say the specifically when a minnow, a lot of different minnows, when their skin is mechanically injured, they have these epithelial cells that release a substance called Schreckstoff, which is an alarm cue that tells their buddies, I'm being eaten, get out of here, right? So that's something that even in a pristine environment, organisms are going to be exposed to, is the smell of predation, right? Or the smell of a predator. So even a predator being in water near a prey item, the thought is that that Schreckstoff from an organism that's consumed by a predator could potentially go through the feces or urine of the predator and be detected by the prey, right? So all of those types of predation cues can cause stress, right? So just knowing that you're about to be eaten can cause stress. So what happens when you are stressed from the thought of I'm about to be eaten, and then also you're exposed to chemicals at the same time that aren't supposed to be there, right? So the entire premise of this was that essentially we're not giving a good representation of wild conditions and what these organisms and aquatic environments are really under, what the type of stress that they're under, when you don't take into consideration that every organism is already under a lot of stress from predation or from trying to gain resources, trying to reproduce, all of the different stresses an organism is already under. Now you dump a bunch of man-made chemicals on top of it, and how are they going to react? So maybe the levels that are set are not really accurate enough. They're not really reflective of true environmental conditions. So
that definitely sounds like it was a big complex project to work on. So you were involved in rearing all these organisms and then testing how the effects affected them, and then comparing that with how you hypothesized natural wild animals would react to those same effects?
Essentially, yeah. I mean, and we were testing very simple compounds. One of them was just sodium chloride. Essentially, the idea was, you know, road salt. If you have receiving systems that normally would not receive a lot of salt from the substrate, that receive high dosages, especially over springtime flows during snow melts and ice melts, and you've got a lot of road salt, what happens in these receiving systems when they receive these pulses of salt? And then the other one, of course, my lab was dealing a lot with heavy metals, and one of them was cadmium. So we also looked at how cadmium affected these organisms, which is a whole other can of worms, because we know that cadmium specifically has the ability to impact, if not completely destroy, the olfactory neuron bulbs of developing fishes. So we were exposing larval fishes that were less than 24 hours old, and we showed that we saw sort of the opposite effect with the salt as we did with the cadmium. So with that, we don't really know if perhaps the olfactory sense of the fish was deadened by the cadmium, and therefore they were unable to smell the predatory cue that we added. And if that's the case, then at low dosages of something like cadmium, essentially you may not cause the fish to die, but you could kill off something like its sense of smell, which could essentially make it more vulnerable to predation throughout its entire life if it were to persist and survive beyond that larval stage. So there were some far-reaching implications to the study that I think I'm still wrapping my head around, even after all these years myself, but it's something that it warrants further investigation for sure.
And I guess you keep referring to organisms. Was there a specific species that you were working with as your...
I was. So we were rearing fathead minnows in the lab. and using the larval individuals that had just hatched 24 hours or less in age, and then Daphnia pulex. So, you know, one of those species of water flea was, well, our lab reared quite a few of these organisms to do bioassays for contract work for, you know, businesses throughout the state would send us water quality tests, their substrate or water, and we would run them through the bioassays. So we had Daphnia pulex, Daphnia magna, we had amphipods that we would use, and then the fathead minnows. So those were the main cultures we kept.
Then after you were finished up at Oklahoma State, you were able to gain employment with the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation, first at the Durant State Fish Hatchery. So right back there in the same town as Southeastern Oklahoma State University. And you were able to raise a whole bunch of different fish species there at the hatchery. Which one of those was your favorite to work with?
Well, so I was able to raise fish at the hatchery and also at the lab. So, you know, I worked with gar at the lab, which we'll get to that in a second. But at the hatchery, you know, we worked with largemouth bass, the Florida strain, bluegill, hybrid sunfish, channel catfish. We did not spawn those ourselves, but we also spawned koi and then goldfish. And of all of those, my favorite was the bluegill. And by the time I was actually about to leave the hatchery, I was in charge of spawning and rearing the bluegill for the hatchery that were part of our farm pond fish program for the state. So they were my little babies. I love the bluegill.
And were you able to grow big bluegill, or was it mostly just big enough just to stock, and then the leftovers were your broodstock for the next year?
Did
you have any giant 10-inchers in your broodstock ponds?
I did not have any of the giants, although if I had only had a handle on them, or I got handed the task of propagating them a year before I left. And so I think if I had had longer, I would have made some monster brooders, but for the most part, the biggest ones I had were the brooders, and they were getting up there by the time I left. I didn't have them near where I wanted them, but they started getting to be quite the babies. I would feed them at specific times of day, and so of course they got used to that schedule, and they would come up. They, of all of the ones at the hatchery, were the slowest usually to come up. But by the time I got done with them, they would just know when I was going to be there, and they would start popping. And I don't know, it was pretty rewarding. I definitely want some more bluegill brooders. I just don't have ponds. That's kind of my dirty secret as the pond lady, is I don't have my own ponds. So,
well, someday you gotta have goals.
Someday.
And so you also mentioned that you raise koi and goldfish, and we raise a little bit of that here in Kansas, so I know what they're for, and some other listeners who work in hatcheries might, but would you mind filling us in on what the koi and goldfish were used for?
Okay, so it's kind of, if I was to be in different circles, depending on where this goes out, it might be a sacrilege, but the koi that we would raise were actually forage fish for our largemouth bass. So we grew the Florida strain, and the Florida strain is for creating the hybrids in our public lakes. So the idea is that you introduce the Florida genes to the northern strain, and you get an F1 or FX, the hybrid of a northern and a Florida, and you get bigger bass. So in order to produce enough bass to get this effect, then we grew lots and lots and lots of Florida bass. To get Florida bass, you have to have lots of food. And most people don't realize that bass don't naturally eat pellets very well. You have to actually train them to eat pellets. And even the best pellet trained bass, if you start introducing live forage back to them, they're going to lose the interest in pellets really quickly. So you can feed them as much pellet food as you want, but once they get the taste for forage, they're going to want live fish. And it's crazy to me to think of how much these koi are probably worth on the market for koi individually, but goldfish we found did not produce the number per acre, the yield that we wanted. So they started growing goldfish to feed the bass because bluegill wasn't enough. They couldn't get them to eat the feed enough. They had to get something that was supplemental, and they just couldn't spend enough on fatheads anyway. So the idea was goldfish. Goldfish didn't produce enough. So in Texas, where they produce their bass, a lot of times they also produce koi to feed the bass. So our hatchery started doing that. I think it was 2012, I believe, 2012 is when that program started down there. And so we would raise ponds and ponds of koi to feed our big bass. So once the bass babies are hatched out and you're draining them out of the ponds, then you're stocking them to public waters at about 1.5 inches in size. But all your brooders then go back to their over summer ponds where they're going to stay until the next year. And you just dump a couple of ponds of koi in there a couple times a year. And that's what the koi are for. So it was very interesting.
So then, after a few years at the Durant State Fish Hatchery, you moved back upstate to Norman, to the Oklahoma Fisheries Research Center. And we mentioned before that you were able to work with some alligator gar and raising some alligator gar there. What were some other the unique projects you were able to be a part of at the Fisheries Research Center?
Well, being in the middle of the state and being a part of the research crew, then we were tasked with helping with projects all over the state. So I was actually able to assist with a restocking effort in a lake. They were trying to introduce and establish a tiger muskie fishery at a lake in the panhandle. That was interesting and crazy. Got to mess with baby tiger muskies and never thought that being in Oklahoma, I'd ever get to say that I could mess with the fish like that in my own state. I got to help spawn walleye and sawgeye. So going out to collect the brood stock and actually go through the process of mixing the milt and the eggs on the shoreline and doing everything by hand, that was really cool. I have gotten to help collect striper brood stock from the Arkansas River. I have gotten to help spawn paddlefish. Gotten to help spawn alligator gar. I've gotten to help spawn short-nosed gar, spotted gar. I've done a lot of work with otoliths on a lot of different species. So age and growth on quite a few different species. In fact, one of my publications is on diet of black bullhead, but a lot of catfish, age and growth stuff. So bullheads were one of the big species we worked with at the lab that I didn't have a lot of experience with before, but now I have a soft spot for all the bullheads. I just love them. I think they're super cute. And I got to work with fish from all over the state in lots of different environments and lots of different capacities in terms of why we were working with them, what we were doing with them, and what the end result was supposed to be. But I've had the opportunity of working with biologists from all over the state, and it's been a wild ride for sure. So
I guess the tiger muskies in Oklahoma caught me off guard and surprised me that they were considering it. Did the stockings take hold out there in the panhandle?
No, unfortunately. Okay, so the precedent was that at Lake Carl Etling in Black Mesa State Park, there was a northern pike fishery at one point. Now, at that point, when it was a successful pike fishery, the lake was much deeper and much colder. Since then, of course, the drainage has changed some, and carp have now entered the system, common carp, and the impoundment has lost a substantial amount of its depth. It has also, because of the carp, significantly increased turbidity now. to the point to where a lot of the macrophytes just aren't really doing as well. And the, you know, fish like muskies that are super dependent on sight, even more so than a lot of our natives, like even bass that are sight feeders, just simply could not persist, you know, over the course of multiple stocking events. You know, we would go out to establish their health, how they were doing post-stocking, and determine the abundances that were left. And just over time, we would see these fish slowly just kind of starving. They couldn't see their prey. They couldn't hunt. So there may be a couple left. I'm hoping that there's some huge individuals that just were lucky enough to be able to chomp down on food when they needed it and get them through. And I really hope there's some big monsters out there that just managed to escape us when we were shocking. But it's a pretty small impoundment. I think it's only like 116 acres. And, you know, we would shock and shock and shock and shock. So you would think that if there were any kind of abundances left, that we would have run across them. So there's a chance there's a few left, maybe, but my heart says they just couldn't really make it. It's too shallow. It's too turbid. And the system isn't the same as what it was before when the pike were there. So that's just unfortunate.
Well, I've been to Oklahoma City, and Oklahoma City and Norman are kind of close to each other and almost bordering. And when I was in Oklahoma City, I visited Skulls Unlimited, the forgot the fancy word for it, but a giant museum of bones.
Osteology
museum.
Yes.
One of your hobbies that you mentioned is that you collect and process skulls and bones for display and education. You currently have 13 species of skulls. Have you been to the museum there in Oklahoma City?
I have not yet, and it's not too far from us. That's kind of one of our things we want to do this summer. So we do nuisance wildlife control. A lot of it is simply, I've got a skunk in the crawl space, a raccoon in my attic, and we set live traps and we relocate animals. So we actually work really closely with the big rehab center here in Oklahoma called Wild Care that knows that we're softies and we have property. And so legally we are able to relocate animals on our own property. But one of the things that we don't actually really relocate, and I'm sure in Kansas, you know a little bit about this, is beavers. So beavers can be extremely damaging to pond ecosystems, causing significant tree fall issues, undermining dams to the point of collapse even. So my husband, part of the worst part of the job, I would say, is having to control beavers. We cannot relocate them. They're so abundant in Oklahoma and they're so territorial that if you were to relocate a beaver to another location where it's not native, then you could actually run the risk of that beaver being killed off due to it fighting, basically. So we do have to remove beavers with kill traps. And as such, sometimes we end up with a lot of beaver carcasses and don't have enough time to process them. So we've actually taken carcasses to the osteology museum, but we've never even been there to see the display, if that tells you anything. So
yep. So you mentioned to me that you have over 13 species of skulls. What are some of the animals that you've collected and processed the skulls for?
Okay. So I've got raccoon, otter, beaver. I've got an alligator gar, although I didn't process that one myself. That one was a gift. I've got deer. I've got coyote, fox. I've got skunk. I've got muskrat, snapping turtle, soft shell turtle, red-eared slider, channel catfish, flathead catfish, and I'm sure I lost track of where we're at that point. But that's all I could think of off the top of my head. I know there's others I'm missing, but there's quite a few of them. Oh, I just put an armadillo in to process. Oh, a deer that my husband harvested a couple years ago. Finally, his skull is going to get processed, but we find a lot of stuff. So I like to say that the bones find me. It's my mystical way of saying that I don't have a problem, right? It's not me being a hoarder. The bones find me. It's not a problem because the bones find me, right? So it's my way of justifying it all. But no, we definitely end up finding a lot. Seems like animals tend to go towards water when they're in dismay or hurt or injured. So you find a lot of dead stuff around ponds and lakes.
We've mentioned a few times in the interview so far that you and your husband work together in a wildlife management business that you both own, and him doing more of the wildlife stuff and you doing the pond stuff. And I'm sure you help each other out quite a bit.
So he started the business with the nuisance wildlife stuff back in 2014. So this was back when I was still working in Durant for the hatchery, and he really wanted to get into more of the land management. So helping people with plans for turkey or quail or deer or burn plans. And, you know, what we found out is that the majority of people really want to do their own land management in Oklahoma. They're much more comfortable with creating their own strategies for whatever they're trying to harvest. So there wasn't a lot of return on that. The return was much more on the nuisance wildlife control. And at the beginning, much more of that was kill trapping, which he does not like. And neither one of us like the kill trapping at all. In fact, after this year, I don't think we can even stand to do the beaver removal anymore. Unfortunately, it's too heartbreaking. So just my experience working with the wildlife department was that we have over 300,000 ponds in Oklahoma. And, you know, Kansas is kind of similar in terms of most of the ponds are man-made. There's not a lot of natural ponds or lakes. Most of them are impoundments that are created for a lot of agricultural purposes mostly. But, you know, there's so many ponds in Oklahoma that the ODWC just can't get to them all. So if they were to start going to some over others, then they're just going to be showing favoritism, and that's not going to go over well either. So invariably, when you work for the department, either as an intern or as a technician, at some point you're going to have to answer the phone. You know, it's the secretary's gone, or we're shorthanded, or you're the only one here today. You've got to answer the phone. And I don't care what day it is, you're going to get a call about ponds. There's just that many here. And it got, even as a technician where my main job wasn't answering the phone, it got real frustrating to take these calls. And, you know, at the lab, coming from the hatchery, I had a lot more pond expertise than the guys at the lab did even. So even then it would be like, here, Amy, you know, talk to them about this or tell them about this. So I could tell people what to do over the phone, but actually having somebody come out there and do the work was totally different. And if you're in the neighborhood, you don't have all of the equipment and applicators licenses and all of that, you know, that you need to take care of your own pond. And most people aren't going to want to do it anyway. So in 2017, I jumped ship and started working for my husband's business full time, which is Robison Wildlife Solutions. And we started offering pond and lake management so that there was somebody that could actually be on the ground to provide all of the strategies that we were recommending over the phone.
So you mentioned you jumped ship in 2017, and I guess you mentioned to me that you have your own electrofishing boat. Did you have that right off the bat, or were you able to get that a little bit later?
No, I never, ever, 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 ever thought I'd have my own electrofishing boat. That was definitely one of the perks of jumping ship was, and it took a while because we don't have money. You know, we live a meager life. We have 20 critters. We live in a house that's from the 50s that's fallen apart. You know, we had a lot of debt accumulated between two different properties, and both of us have student loans, and all of that accumulates. And so we just didn't really have what it what it took to get business loans. So we really have had to be self-sufficient, and it took a few years to get the money together to buy the box. I mean, the box itself is really the expensive part. And things have come a long way since then. Those systems are way cheaper than they used to be, but it also helps because the process to get the permit to use the electrofishing boat in Oklahoma isn't super easy. I mean, you definitely have to put in your dues, and they have to know that you're capable of using the equipment. They're not just going to give that permit to anyone that decides mm-hmm. to apply for it. So it doesn't hurt that they had to deal with me for 6 years. So I think we went through our first full year without having the boat and doing more of the restoration stuff, which is, to be honest, the electrofishing stuff is not the majority of what we do anyway. Most ponds, especially neighborhood ponds, there are a few people in the neighborhood that do like to fish. The chances are that the neighborhood's not really going to want to pay to do an electrofishing survey if they don't have to. So to be honest, it's mostly our rural landowners, the guys that want the 10 pound bass in their pond. And so, yeah, it is nice to have an electrofishing boat though. I definitely like to brag about that one, because I don't feel like most people can say they have an electrofishing boat in their shop at their house. So,
yep. So before you had the boat, you mentioned most of your work is just restoration work. I imagine that was a lot of aquatic vegetation control around ponds and that sort of stuff, controlling siltation and that sort of thing, and working with landowners.
Yes. And a lot of what we do, you know, we have a different approach than some of the other types of aquatic managers that are in the area in terms of how we approach just management overall. You know, if we can teach you how to do something, we're much more likely to do that than to try to charge you for something that you could do yourself, if that makes sense. And, you know, I guess it at the end of the day definitely shows that we are biologists. We're definitely not the best at business, because our strategy is much more about disseminating knowledge, conservation, creating stewards out of our landowners, giving people the knowledge and the expertise to be able to take care of their land or their water themselves. You know, if we have to start with restoration, get some aquatic vegetation in check, you know, teach them how to do what they need to do, that's great. But at the end of the day, you know, we never want to get them stuck in a contract where we're on the hook with them, or they're on the hook with us for monthly payments or years of service. That's, we know people that do that, and it's just not sustainable. And for the most part, what we see is the people that do that are just spraying chemicals over and over and over again. And that's just not a sustainable way of managing any type of ecosystem. So a lot of it too is teaching people that a pond is not a swimming pool, you know, mm-hmm. what's good, what's bad. You know, you can't have 200 ducks and geese on a quarter acre pond, or you can't cut down and mow down all of the vegetation to the very edge of the pond and expect your banks to retain their rigidity, or, you know, just things that I think as fisheries managers, we sort of take for granted. But if you get into these neighborhoods where landowners literally do want their pond to look like a swimming pool, and they don't understand what happens when you try to treat a pond like a swimming pool, then it you can get a lot of fight, a lot of pushback, and a lot mm-hmm. of people think that you're trying to take them for a ride, or you're not giving the correct information, or you have some ulterior motive because it's not what they've been told forever by Joe Blow down the street that's been throwing chemicals in once a month for 5 years or whatever. So mm-hmm. there is a lot of education involved in what we do, and a lot of bad information. You're in Kansas, so you know a little bit of some of that Wild West stuff that happens, especially with wildlife and neighborhoods, and people don't know better.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you guys do a lot of the live trapping and the relocating and that sort of thing, and you have your own property that you're able to relocate some of these animals onto. And you mentioned it in one of your answers already, but that you guys have 20 different pets Are some of these, some of the animals that you've relocated, that are almost kind of domesticated, or are they all dogs and cats?
No, unfortunately, we don't have our rehab permit. So even if there was an animal that was a wild animal that couldn't necessarily be released, then that animal goes to the rehab center because they have the permits to be able to keep those animals and then make the decision as to whether something is a candidate for release or not. If it isn't a candidate for release, they make the decision as to what happens then. Ours are all domestics or non-natives. So we have 5 cats, 2 dogs. We have 3 tortoises that are all non-native. We do have some pet store fails, I will call them, that were supposed to be feeders. So we have a rescued ball python. So we have some pet rats that were supposed to be feeders for another snake that we had that was ill. And we thought that if we got some live food, it would encourage her to eat. Well, the snake died and the food didn't. So we have some pet rats. We have a rescued bearded dragon. We have a rescued donkey. We also, for a while here, seems like there was this whole micro pig thing going on where a lot of people were getting pet pigs as like house pets. So we have 4 of those that were relinquished by their owners. Yeah, I think that's everybody at this point, if I can run down the list. Oh, and then we have a bait bucket release fail. So this was, since we do a lot of pond stocking, sometimes we will get bass, sunfish, carp, you know, the sterile grass carp or whatever. Last year we ended up going to our fish vendor and he had gotten a load of, you know, the water dogs, the tiger salamander nymphs, the juvenile tiger salamanders. And the gentleman that was helping us was from Mexico. And for whatever reason, he was terrified of one of the tiger salamanders that had metamorphosed into an adult. And he was there in the raceway at the hatchery. I say hatchery, it's our fish vendor. He has a couple of raceways on his property. And so he just stores the fish until he sells them. And for whatever reason, this guy was terrified of the tiger salamander, wouldn't touch him, said he was poisonous. He was just like, no, he's poisonous. I don't want him. I was like, well, can I have him? And he said, of course. And he bagged him up. And so we have a pet tiger salamander now. So too. His name's Pipsqueak, so, you know.
Well, Amy, I think we've filled the episode long enough, and I'm sure you got to go feed at least one of your 20 different pets. So now we're down to the final 5 questions, and this is a group of 5 questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show, and we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
Flathead catfish.
Did you get work on those when you were in working in the research center?
I have not gotten to work on them much. I had plans in place to start a project on them before I decided to leave. So that was where I was hoping my research was going to eventually take me. But I have always been fascinated by them. And I got the chance to go noodling for the first time a couple years ago. And I definitely got the bug for it. So I kind of feel like I rooted for the right catfish my whole life for good reasons. So I don't know. I've always found them fascinating. They're voracious predators, top dogs on the food chain. I want to put them in all my ponds. I just don't know why my landowners won't let me.
Amy, so what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
Oh, that is tough. I would have to say that probably my favorite so far was getting to net for the baby alligator gar in Lake Texoma. So I've always been obsessed with Lake Texoma. Got to spend a lot of time there growing up as a kid and then going back as an adult many, many times for work or for fun, and getting to go out into some of the flat areas and marshy recesses of Texoma that don't look like you're even in Oklahoma anymore. Finding baby gator gar was pretty fantastic. Although working on Oklahoma alligators is right up there with it though. So alligator gar, American alligators. Those two are hard to beat.
And did you ever bump into that famous Oklahoman from the Texoma area, Mr. Blake Shelton?
Okay. No, I did not personally. However, where our property is down in Durant, America, is not far, supposedly, from where his ranch is. And the people that own the property that our piece of property was originally cut from, their property, they have a couple of little boys, and they swear that they know Blake. So that's about as close as I've ever gotten to it.
I'd imagine he keeps a pretty secretive life when he makes it back to Oklahoma. Doesn't want too much attention.
And down in that part of Oklahoma, it would be really easy to get away with because there is not a lot out there but cows. So,
well, maybe that, I mean, you're from there, so it might be your dream location to wind up in, but it sounds like you have a pretty nice gig going now. So what is your dream job or dream location to work in?
Oh, you know what? At this point, there's a lot of wanting and wishing and hoping and dreaming out there, but I don't think that I could ask for a better place than where I am now. And I don't think I could ask for a better job than what I'm doing. I really don't.
And you're kind of out of the research game now, but maybe there's a pond rehab you want to do. If money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
I would say that the biggest thing that I would like to tackle statewide is to follow up with a lot of the old work that was done to document where a lot of our native species are across the state and in what drainages. So if money really wasn't an object, and I'm hoping that it eventually gets to this point to where I can send my teams out to do the actual work, and then I get to go do what I want to do for fun and still get paid to do that. But I'd really like to start documenting where some of our most vulnerable endemic species are outside of where they are documented in terms of public waters. So it's easy enough to locate these species in public waters that state and federal agencies have access to, but I'm interested in knowing where they are all over the state. So really getting a handle on where species are located and what watersheds across the state is super important to me.
And finally, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
That every living system has an equivalent that can be understood in some capacity. So regardless of the scale of the system we're talking about, whether it's a drop of water or the ocean itself, there are similarities that can be scaled up or scaled down. So that if nothing else, if we think of our own bodies as a reflection of what can happen to the earth itself and realize that what's happening to the earth is a reflection of what can happen to our bodies if they're in a state of disrepair or neglect, that maybe people would care a little more about the earth and about these ecosystems. Maybe if they realized how similar they are to their own bodies, that they would understand just how much impact little things have on the whole planet.
Well, Amy, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and all your diverse work. We didn't even get to some of the other fascinating things about you. So maybe we'll have to have you on again later to catch up and hear some of those other stories.
I would love that. And I guarantee you give me as much time as you want and I will fill up that time. I've done some interesting things in my day and been exposed to some crazy situations. And just by the nature of the work I do, I'm always seeing a variety of not just problems, but ways that people behave, ways that we can modify how people behave, and just overall it's a very dynamic line of work. There's always something new. So I'd love to come back on again. If you got the time, I can fill it. That's for sure.
All right. And if people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
Well, you can find me on Instagram at The Pond Lady, also on Twitter at The Pond Lady. And that's the_pond_lady on both of those. Or if you'd like to find us on our website, it's Robison Wildlife, Robison Wildlife.com. Or feel free to email me, just thepondlady, all one word, at outlook.com.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find the whole podcast gang on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at fisheriespod, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon or by purchasing some awesome Fisheries Podcast logo shirts and hoodies available on Teespring. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 124th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, every living system is relatable.